So my talk today is about nanoflares. And this is a study which is still ongoing in collaboration with Rekha Jain, who is a postdoc at UMIS in Manchester, and Yukio Katsukawa, who is a PhD student of Saku Tsuneta in Tokyo University. So the question is, if corona is hit by nanoflares, the small flare-like events which cannot be resolved individually by observations, how is it any way to test and to probe these nanoflares? And this is a very simple model which I would like to present, which hopefully grasps some robust features of nanoflare heated corona. And the model is extremely simple. If the number of dimensions in your study gives you a level of sophistication of this, this is a zero-dimensional MHD we are exploring. So the line of thinking is that let us assume that corona indeed is hit by small flare-like events, nanoflares, and what we can say from observations about this. And of course, the only way to do this is to study statistical properties of hot coronal loops heated by nanoflares, because each individual nanoflares is beyond observational resolution. So what we did? So let's assume that these nanoflares have a broad energy spectrum, and I will assume it's a linear distribution with energy. So dou w is the energy deposition by individual nanoflare, and this, I assume that this is a power law spectrum, and it should be quite steep. So this index alpha should be greater than 2. Then the small events contribute to the energy deposited into the corona. And the amplitude of this is determined by Q. Q is a heating flux per unit area, which an active inch in the corona is about 10 to the 7 ergs per square centimeter per second. So this gives you a normalization of this distribution.
W is duration.
Sorry?
W is the duration.
Delta W is the energy deposition. It's amount of energy, quantum of energy, of each nanoflare, and they have a growth energy distribution from some minimum energy to maximum.
So these are instantaneous events, right?
Pardon?
These are instantaneous events, discrete events.
Yeah. It will be clear from what will follow. So the first question is, if you have an individual nanoflare, how corona responds to it? So what are the basic assumptions here? Because if this energy deposition is by, say, reconnection, then the spatial scale of primary energy deposition should be very small. It should be like a current sheet or something like that. And because of this, the energy which is deposited with this heat cannot remain localized in this very small region, because otherwise the pressure will be very big there. So one can assume that when the energy is deposited and this is the most simple. Assume that this happens in a uniform magnetic field. If you have some energy deposition here, what will happen? It will immediately spread along the field line and also expand in the perpendicular direction. And in this case, I assume that until its pressure, thermal pressure inside this individual filament created by nanoflare will be balanced by magnetic pressure of the external field. Of course, there is possible that there is a diffusion, but simple estimates gives that diffusion maybe is not very important. So this gives like the cross-section of this filament derived in this way. It's like a lower bound for the cross-section area of the individual filament created by nanoflare.
So do I understand that you're assuming that you get some kind of equipartition between thermal energy and magnetic energy? Is that what you're saying?
It's better to say equipartition between the pressure. The thermal pressure inside this filament is balanced by the magnetic pressure outside it. Because if it expands with the field. So after this expansion, internal field is much lower than external field. But this is a very crude estimate. But I think the only reasonable thing for this is the bigger is nanoflare, I mean the bigger is delta W, the bigger is the filament, which is quite reasonable. And this is like a lower bound of this cross-section area. Okay, now we have this filament. What is it? Evolution. When you have this hot plasma inside it, it starts to cool. And there are two channels for energy losses. One is heat conduction along the filament, another is radiation. Because initially it's something like, which cannot be described in a simple hydrodynamic way, but this initial phase, which is not shown here, it's very quick. So it doesn't matter for, you will see later, doesn't matter for the whole story. If you're looking for emission measure, the contribution of this to the hot emission measure is negligibly small because it's very fast. So after some thermalization, we come to plasma with temperature T and density N. And at this stage, normally, conductivity prevails over radiation. So it's just a conductive cooling of the plasma. But this heat flux, when it comes to the dense chromosphere, starts to evaporate plasma from it. So we have inflow of enthalpy into the loop. So altogether, the thermal energy inside the loop at this conductive stage remains unchanged. But the temperature is going down and density is going up. But in the course of this evolution, this cooling the conductive time becomes longer and radiation time becomes shorter, and eventually you have a transition from this conductive cooling to radiative cooling. And at this radiative cooling, there is also some plasma drain out of the loop down. So the evolution of density is like this. So altogether, we can estimate what is the lifetime of this filament. This is the lifetime of hot filament. And this is just simply the sum of these two phases, and this is an estimate of this cooling time.
And the magnetic field dependence comes because of this?
Because of the pressure. Yeah. All, basically, B is a measure of the pressure inside this filament. So you can rewrite everything in terms of the pressure inside filament. So B comes from this pressure balance requirement. And to give you an example, what about this time? So if you have 30 Gauss and 10 to the 9 centimeters, this lifetime is about 10 minutes or so, about 1,000 seconds.
Are you saying that the time the loop spends cooling conductively is the same, always the same as the time it spends cooling radiatively?
Yeah, about the same, about order of magnitude. You can just, because look, when you go down, the instantaneous cooling time becomes longer and longer at this stage. At this stage, it becomes shorter and shorter. So the longest cooling time is here. So all the lifetime is determined by this point where radiation and conductive cooling are about the same. And this is very important for all predictions which can be made, because if you look on the filament, because the longer time it stands at this point, the most likely to find it with this temperature. And now, if you switch these nanoflares, many of them with this power law spectrum, and wait for a time much longer than the lifetime of individual filament, you will reach some sort of a steady state when the number of creating new filaments will be equal to the number of dying filaments. So this is a statistical steady state, And I'm interested in the features of this steady state. And we made a Monte Carlo simulation of this. And this shows you a snapshot of the loop, which consists of a large number of filaments. So this is, for example, of magnetic field 20 Gauss and spectral index. So each filament is a circle here. And the color shows you the temperature. The temperature scale is somewhere here. So cool is blue and hot is red. So you see here filaments with a different stage of their lifetime. Young, old, and so on. But if you change the index alpha, the bigger is alpha, the more discriminated are big events. So the size of circles becomes smaller when spectral the energy of nanoflares, the majority of nanoflares is smaller. But if you change the magnetic field, this is for the same alpha, but different magnetic field. When you have a stronger magnetic field, this transition temperature becomes bigger. So these filaments becomes hotter. It's more yellowish and brownish than this greenish. But the size of the filaments becomes smaller. And if you now make the same for a bigger index alpha, then the size of filaments become even smaller because, again, big events are discriminated. So this is a snapshot. And now about the distribution of filaments and emission measure with temperature. As I already mentioned, this temperature, when you have transition from radiative time, from conductive time to radiative time, this is the longest time in the evolution time life of the filament. Then if you plot the distribution of the volume, filling factor, the differential filling factor with the temperature, this is the temperature over here, you will find that this distribution is peaked at this transition temperature. This doesn't matter because this is a cold plasma which does not contribute to X-ray emission. But if you plot emission measure, that it's peaked even stronger because density is going up because of the chromospheric evaporation. So the distribution of the emission measure with temperature is very much peaked at this temperature T star, where the transition, where radiation time is equal to the cooling time, conductive time, cooling time. And the stronger is magnetic field, this transitional temperature becomes bigger. So this is for 20 Gauss and this is for 50 Gauss. And now, if you look on this loop, which consists of these filaments distributed like this with a broad range X-ray telescope, the temperature which will be observed is very likely to be very close to this peak in the emission measure. So from this very simple consideration, you can immediately predict what will be the temperature of this coronal loop heated by nanoflares. And this is this temperature.
You said that the loop density goes up because of chromospheric evaporation, yeah. But there's no modeling of that explicitly in your model. We don't have any calculations of.
No, I did not make this calculation, but there are a lot of one-dimensional HD models of this, and if you compare this simple model with, they agree very well, fits very well with this one-dimensional codes. So it's like this is the quintessence of this more detailed.
Okay, but that emission measure curve that you got, which peaked at a certain temperature, that arises from your
Yeah, because this one-dimensional idea, this is just evolution of individual filament. Mm-hmm. And now I have a broad distribution of them. So I skip all the details of one filament for the sake of studying many of them. Because in principle, of course, you can take million filaments, and if you have a good computer, you can do it. But I don't think it makes a lot of big sense. So this is the temperature, this is peak temperature, this is the most likely temperature which you will get from the instrument like SXT, when you look with the, on the coronal loop, heated by nanoflares. What is interesting is that this temperature doesn't depend on the heating rate at all. This is just a measure of the length and magnetic field, or in other words, the pressure. But if you look more carefully on this, this is just exactly Rosner-Tucker-Vajana relation. Because for this statistical steady state, the peak is where conductive time is equal to radiation time. So we come back to Rosner-Tucker-Vajana scaling, but for very different reasoning, because the original scaling was for steady state heating of one loop. And this is a statistical distribution of many filaments where which are evolving dynamically individual. But the on average distribution is steady. And just to give you an example.
Do you worry about the dependence on magnetic field strength? I mean, the fact that, that different parts of the corona with different field strengths should have different temperatures, and temperatures tend not to vary by.
Yeah, but the magnetic field in the corona is also varies not very much. If you look on all the data, it's not more than like a factor of two in the coronal field. Of course, there's no direct measurements so far on the coronal magnetic field.
That's not quite true. There's measurements from radio of coronal field strengths. Stephen White's been doing measurements using, I don't know what frequency it is, but basically looking at gyro synchrotron emission in coronal fields. And there are kind of hot spots in terms of magnetic field, but I don't know.
Those gyro synchrotron measurements usually produce hundred gauss fields. Now it's always in a flare.
Yeah, I guess so.
They're always observing magnetic field strength in flares.
Yeah, but again, you should bear in mind that this comes from a very simple model. Mm-hmm. So I think the only thing which comes through of this is that there is indication that the stronger the field, the higher temperature you can expect. And just to give you an example, for this 10 to the 9 and 30 gauss, this temperature is about 4 million Kelvin, and the density which is peaked at this temperature is about 3 times 10 to the 10 per cubic centimeters.
Does the power exponent alpha come into this expression?
Sorry?
The power exponent alpha that you use, does it enter this relationship?
No.
It's independent.
I will talk about it later, but the bottom line is that all these average statistical properties, they do not depend on the power law spectrum alpha, neither on the energy of nanoflare. The only factor which determines them is Q, the energy balance. So I will speak a little bit later how to probe these more intrinsic features of nanoflares. So this is temperature. And now you can easily calculate what is the filling factor, because if you know what is the occurring rate of nanoflares, this is flux per energy of a nanoflare, typical energy, which is minimum energy, because alpha seems to be quite big, bigger than 2. And then you should multiply this by the area and by the lifetime of nanoflare, this. So this is the number of hot filaments in the loop in terms of energy balance, energy of nanoflare, and all this. Just again to give you an example for this length, this field, and this area, cross-sectional area, and this heat flux, the number of hot filaments will be about 20,000. And filling factor is just the number of nanoflares times the fraction of the volume they got. So this is the estimate of the filling factor. And again, it does depend on the energy balance Q, but only on the integral energy Q, not on the alpha, not on the energy of the individual nanoflare. And of course, you can also, you can estimate that normally it should be small, about percent or even smaller. This is a total energy and total emission measure. Again, the only characteristic of the heat sink is Q here. And when you have this expression, of course, it's tempting to compare them with some observational scaling laws. There are a number of them. There's the old one given by Golub, how thermal energy depends on the flux. So this is another magnetic field and cross-sectional size D. This is Shibata scaling. This is scaling given by George in his 98 paper. But I tried to, now if you would like to match this with our prediction, it might be possible to find out what is the tau Q, because the only unknown factor here is Q and magnetic field. So to make some predictions about the variance dependence of the heating on Q and the size on magnetic field and the size of the loop. But so far, I did not manage to get some reasonable comparison between this and this. But you can roll this in another way. Let's look on some particular loops observed by SXT and find out what information we can get about these loops from the observations. And this is given on this table. Jim Pinchak spent a lot of time studying Yoka loops. So I took five loops from his paper with Peter Cargill. And so what is the procedure? Well, let's take one loop. One, we observe, you know, from observation its length, its diameter, and temperature. Then from our expression for the temperature, you can derive what is the magnetic field. It comes, in this case, 33 Gauss. Then you know from observation what is emission measure. And from our analysis, you can find what is Q. In this case, it's about 4 times 10 to the 4, 10 to the 6. And then, if you know Q, B, and cross this, you can calculate what is the filling factor. And for this particular loop, it comes to about 5%. And there is, if you look on the loop 2, it comes to this filling factor, loop 3, this. But there are some loops which do not fit well into the scheme. This is also mentioned in our conference in the beginning of this program by Jim Klimchak, so-called overdense loops. So, for example, loop 4, we get filling factor very close to 1, which maybe fit just fit the common sense. But this loop 5 certainly does not. So probably there are some another source of the density of this loop than just chromospheric evaporation. But I don't know the answer. As far as I understand, nobody knows at the moment what is the why it's, the emission measure is so big. And just to conclude about this part, so what is the basic prediction of this model is a killing factor. And the only way to get observational evidence of the killing factor is to have the actual density of the emitting plasma from some spectroscopic observations and to compare it with the total emission measure. But as far as I know, it has not been done in systematic way for loops. It has been done for flares, but again, the spread is enormous in the filling factor. It may be 10 to the minus 4, and it goes again up to the 1.
Griffiths and I did a study with Sumer trying to look at the density-sensitive oxygen 4 lime ratio in the quiet sun.
Uh-huh.
And we also found, we really couldn't understand the results except by invoking small
thermal. You don't understand because
no.
the spread of the heating factor is...
We could never come up with a satisfactory physical explanation that made any sense. Maybe it makes sense to look at it again in terms of what you're finding here. The density was extremely high relative to what the emission measure suggested.
Yeah, but this is good. It means that heating factor is small. But to what extent, what is the heating factor which you can get from this data?
I don't remember, but it's in our papers.
So in general, I think small heating factor, this is in the favor of non-nuclear scenario. Okay, so this is the end of the first part. This is some integral characteristics which depend on the NQ but cannot touch the energy of nanoflare and this spectrally big sulfur. So the question is how to probe this. And surprisingly, there are some, I will mention now, some observations which looks like they are able to tackle this. But in principle, how to do this? It's to look about on the variability. So far, I talked about the mean values of the mean emission measure, mean thermal energy, and so on. But from the variability of, or sometimes called transient brightenings in the X-ray emission, you can hopefully get some information about these two parameters. And the basic, I will talk a little bit later. So just to give you an idea, it's very simple. So if you look on this diagram, so this is evolution of the thermal energy in this loop with time. So you switch nanoflare engine, then you reach steady state. But of course, you have some fluctuations. And this shows you the same variation of the thermal energy for the same Q, the same energy balance, but for different alpha. When you have big alpha, big events are almost non-existent. You have small fluctuations. When you have smaller alpha, then big events are very much pronounced. So this is the simple indication that looking on the variability, you can, in principle, probe energy of individual nanoflares and their distribution with energy. And what people did so far about this, they just look on big events, just for the very simple reason that big events are easy to observe. So they're looking for the so-called microflares and try to find out what is the energy spectrum. And at present, the results are quite controversial because some people claim that alpha, this spectrum is greater than 2, but some found just the opposite. But this issue is very sensitive because to translate observations into emission measure, you should make two spectral index. You should make a lot of assumptions about the geometry of the emitting plasma as well as about the filling factor, for example, because to translate emission measure into energy, you should know the real density, which contributes to the thermal energy. So maybe this is not so surprising that we have a spread and alpha. But another possibility we shall be talking now is to look on small events, on small deviations, small fluctuations. It's not event, it's not like a noise. So I will talk a little bit about it because there are observational data from SXT about this, which give some idea about the energy of the nanoflare. And this is about this observation, this analysis made by Takutawa and Sunet and published last year. So what they did? So this is active region. I don't remember its name. It doesn't matter. You can find it in the paper. And they looked on with individual pixel on different parts of this active region. And for each individual pixel, they had this variability in the intensity. And then they, from this variability, they, for each pixel, they derived a histogram of a distribution of the intensity of radiation. And from this histogram, in principle, it's possible to find out what is the energy of nanoflare, which is from, if it is behind this. So I will discuss this now. But before I go to details of these observations, just a few words what in principle you can expect about these fluctuations. So if you have all nanoflares of the same size, delta W, the intensity, the mean intensity observed by the pixel will be just area observed by the pixel, exposure time, this Q, energy balance, and C is a conversion coefficient for the instrument. And so this is not, and this is deviation from I naught. And for if all nanoflares are the same size, then it's just a Gaussian distribution with a width, which is derived by the square root of the mean number of hot filaments present in this area covered by the pixel. So if you now calculate what is this mean number of filaments, it's determined by the lifetime of the filament. And then you can find out what is the width of this histogram, given like this. So this is coefficient of the instrument, mean intensity, energy of nanoflare, and the ratio of exposure time and lifetime of the nanoflare. But if you have a, this is for all nanoflares having the same energy. So the tail is exponentially small because you need a lot of nanoflares coming in one phase to make a big splash. But when you have a broad energy spectrum of nanoflares, the distribution might be different. You can assume that small events due to this Gaussian-like distribution near zero, this is the deviation from the mean. This is superposition of many small events, so this is noise-like Gaussian form. And then you have a big events are not exponentially small. They have a power law because they are given by single nanoflare with a big energy. So this is like a Poissonian, and this tail, power law tail. So this is noise-like, this is event-like part of the distribution. But how to derive this sigma n, this part for the power law spectrum?
Are you proposing that the events are distributed with a Gaussian or a Gaussian with a tail rather than a power law?
So what I assume, I will show you the real result, that for small deviations, there are mainly a superposition of many small nanoflares. So in this, you look on this part, is the same like for nanoflares of the same energy. The small events, which are much more numerous than big ones. But if you look on the big deviations, then, of course, it's much more likely that one big event occurs and give you a small deviation than many small ones.
I mean, before you were arguing that they were distributed as a power law.
Yeah. Nanoflares are distributed the power law. But if you look on the histogram of the emission measure, then distribution would be like this.
If the nanoflares are distributed like a power law, then
yeah,
the emission measure will be distributed.
It's a deviation of the emission measure from its mean value. You will see in a minute.
Okay.
Because it's not necessarily true for any power law. Wait a minute. Now, how to derive this sigma n? You should look at some energy interval of nanoflares, calculate what is the mean number of filaments, and then take fluctuation as square root of this mean number. And then calculate what is the emission variation given by this fluctuation in the number of filaments. And then integrate it all over the power law spectrum. And the answer is that this width or this Gaussian part is proportional to this integral. So you see that this is the higher moment of the distribution of nanoflares. It's E square. So if power law index alpha is less than 3, then this integral is formally divergent on the upper limit. So it means that in this case, will be known this Gaussian center distribution. So in this case, everything is determined by big events in their more sophisticated interference. But I will give you a numerical result in a minute. But if alpha is greater than 3, then result is very similar to the mono-energetic nanoflares. The only difference, this is the Poissonian, the Gaussian width, is the same. Instead, there is effective energy, which is minimum energy times this factor, which is not very much. But if alpha is very close to 3, it becomes big, but in general, it's a order of unity. And what is shown here is the histogram of this fluctuation from this Monte Carlo simulation. And you really see here, if alpha is greater than, sorry, is less than 3, smaller than 3, like here and here, there is nothing similar to Gaussian distribution. But if alpha is greater than 3, this is very close to Gaussian law here. Of course, there is also a tail, which is power law, which is not shown here, because its magnitude is much smaller. But for this case, the distribution is very different. It's skewed, the maximum is skewed to the negative deviations because big events counterbalance the skew. So you need an average going to zero. But now, the most interesting part, just a couple of minutes, about the observations made by, or analysis made by Katsukawa and Tsuneta. So what they observed. Of course, in real life, there are many other factors which contribute to the width of this histogram. And the major one is photon noise. So what they did, forget about this, this is the this Gaussian distribution for different pixels. There are pixels with different intensity. This is smaller intensity than power 1.5. This is a bigger intensity. And what is shown in this dashed line is photon noise, because photon statistics give you also the Gaussian distribution. And what they discovered that for pixels with big intensity, the actual width is bigger than the photon noise. And then they assumed that this might be probably because of nanoflares. So from studying this width, its principle, you can make an estimate what is the energy of nanoflares if this is behind this width. Of course, there are some other factors which can contribute to this. For example, jittering of the spacecraft. But they estimated that this jittering is much smaller than this actual width. So now you can apply just the expression I gave a minute ago. And from this analysis, find out what is the energy. So from for their instrument, this is a photon noise, which is always proportional to the square root of intensity. And they found for pixel with intensity bigger than 500, this is a data count for this pixel, the actual noise, which can be attributed to nanoflares, is bigger than this, given approximately by this expression. Now, from If you know the exposure time, risk coefficient of the instrument, and you know, now about this lifetime of the filament, you actually don't need to derive it, because if you look on the time variation of the intensity, it gives you what is the lifetime of the filament, because the time scale of this equation is roughly the lifetime of the filament, if filaments are behind it, of course. So this is 40 minutes, so from this equation you can assume that it's several minutes, 3-5 minutes. So if you now insert this lifetime into here, surprisingly you find that nanoflare has the energy of a nanoflare in this case, if it's true, about 10 to 23 ergs. And then you can estimate what is the number of filaments for each pixel. It's about 300, and the total number, the occurrence rate of nanoflares for this, the whole active region, which is about 5,000 per second for this active region. That's it. Thank you.
So I had a question on one of, a couple of your basic premises, but the first one is, why do you assume in the beginning that the pressure inside the filament is equal to the magnetic pressure on the outside?
Because I try to understand what happens if you have explosion very much localized in space.
But you could have it. I mean, your explosion could release less energy than that. There's nothing to prevent that.
Less energy than what?
Than the magnetic pressure. Also.
Yeah, but then the size of this entity will be smaller.
Though couldn't it just be distributed over a wider area with a lower energy?
Yeah, what I assume that the size, the filament is not existent before the nanoflare occurs.
Okay.
And the size of the filament is determined by the, how much
just
energy
just
you put into
premise.
It. Yeah, yeah. Of course, you can argue about the about this equation, and or you can put it another way. If this individual filament beta is 1, roughly, so it means that the whole active region, average beta is just filling factor. But of course, if the field is not as simple as uniform field, which of course is the case, then you might expect that the actual shape and everything might be quite different from the simple, but I don't think it should. I think the basic assumption that magnetic fields should somehow determine its size, I don't see any alternative to this if diffusion is not that big.
Wouldn't that mean these things would be much wider at the top where the magnetic field strength is presumably weaker? Right? That they'd actually, in order to reach a beta equals one situation, they'd be narrower at the top.
Probably. But it doesn't contradict with what Klimchak said, because they observing, you may
but
say
he
that
observes,
the whole loop is
almost
it?
The same width the whole way.
Yeah, but they cannot resolve the individual filament.
I see. But this model does not include variation
at all. Okay, it's very crude, of course. If you have a more complicated field, then it's not easy to find out what shape and what it looks like. But I think the basic assumption that the bigger is event, the bigger will be the filament, it looks more or less.
So I had another kind of question related to my first one. In the case, what were you assuming about the cooling? You were saying that the cooling time, the filament, was that the, are you finding the cooling time as the time for the pressure to decrease or the time for the temperature to decrease or some combination of those two?
It's better to say the cooling time is the time when you can, this filament emits X-rays, so its temperature is high. Because density, what going on, temperature is going down, density is going up. So if you observe it, it's more likely that you will see it on the moment when the density is at its maximum.
It's going to say that the pressure actually doesn't change during
this operation. Yeah, exactly.
Right. It only changes when you get a lot of radiative losses.
Yeah, but then it becomes quickly cold and beyond of interest.
I understand that in your model, you have instantaneous energy release somewhere along the field line. Does it matter what is the nature of this explosion, whether it's due to the connection or?
Yeah, this simple model, it doesn't matter. What does matter that it's very fast and very localized. It's two basic assumptions.
I have kind of an outsider's question. How does this non-flare heating relate to that kind of thermal damage in heating that Boris talked about in the last talk? Is it antagonistic or the same thing or something in between?
In principle, they are complementary, I think. So that was my idea, which I will try to pursue somehow, to make a statistical analysis of this numerical simulation and find out what is the statistics of heating events there.
And do you guys know anything about the statistics of heating in the simulations?
Well, you can find a histogram in one of Klaus's papers, I don't remember which, that has characters similar to the observed power loss. But the range is, of course, much too small. And we still don't have a physical understanding why you would know. We're still far, far behind in this area, understanding how you actually go about getting a power loss or but most likely that the power law comes about from the basic chemistry equation somehow.
I am in contact now with Klaus, and we are suggesting to do something about it.
As I mentioned for several before, there's this neat argument that if nanoflare estimates fail by a factor of 10, that's sort of a conclusion. If you add up these power laws and you count up the ergs, it's about a factor of 10 to live. But that means that just 10% fluctuations in our heating mechanism, whatever, can account for the power law. If it is a power law, if it has the right distribution, well, you can just have a 10% fluctuation in the general heating, and that will account for the so-called nanoflare.
Okay, can you say on the basis of your simulations that most of the heating comes from localized heating events? Or is there a smooth component too?
Yeah, certainly most of it is both intermittent in space and in time. And the wider you make the resolution range, the wider will the power load count, obviously.
But the big question is, what's the slope on that power load?
Yes, and why, exactly. And that's where we're much further in ordinary turbulence than here. Assuming the same kind of method should work, eventually we'll be able to expand the slopes.
Also, I mean, intermittency means it's like a fractal subset of space and time. But how many dimensions does that subset have?
Good question.
Yeah, the power law is much better constrained for larger events. And there, I think it's pretty well nailed down to be alpha is about 1.5.
As low as that.
As low as that. If you actually calculate energy and not what a lot of earlier investigators did.
You're talking about flares or about
flares and transient brightenings. A lot of previous investigators based it on peak X-ray fluids, or peak X-ray emission rate, and then they get higher values. But if you actually calculate the energies being released, and McTiernan and Roman did a job for flares of estimating that based on HXT,
they're using IC3.
Oh, IC3, that's right, I'm sorry. Someone else did it,
Crosby
did it with the HXT. Right, and there you can actually get the spectrum of the higher.
That was with Batsy, that wasn't HXT. I don't know if anyone's done with HXT.
And then, well, recently, it is Crosby with the new Dutch experiment.
Danish.
That's it.
But I would still think this idea of looking at the X-ray variability, that must tell you something, give you some information at least about.
But sorry, looking at
the X-ray variability, yeah. Looking pixel by pixel and looking at the time.
That's much closer also to what Benz and Crooker do, which is basically look pixel by pixel at EIT.
But they are searching for individual events. That's the difference.
They haven't actually identified events.
Yeah.
You just look for pixels that
The other thing too is these weird spectroscopic density results that you get where you see an emission measure,
in transition region structures that implies a density like 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10. But when you look at the actual density, the line ratio, the density sensitive line ratio, so it's like an order of magnitude higher.
Right, but filling factors from those arguments never go much beyond 10 to the minus 3, do they? No, you never see an average emission measure that's 10 to the 9, and then see an active, see a density sensitive diagnostic give you a density of 10 to the 14.
No, it's like one or two orders of magnitude.
It's never more than two orders of magnitude in filling.
But the two orders of magnitude is still pretty hard.
Oh yeah.
To cope with, in my opinion.
It's 10 minus 4.
But I don't think you get 10 to the minus 4.
Yeah, you don't get 10 to the minus 4.
You never get 10 to the minus 4. Just 10 to the minus 3.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about this.
Yeah.